Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Christian Sager. Hey, so did you know that you can not only listen to us on this podcast, but you can engage with us on social media and read stuff that we've written and watch stuff that we're in? We're all over the place. We're not just in your earbuds.
It's a crazy time to be alive.
Yeah, it is. It is indeed. If you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Tumblr, where we are Blow the Mind on all those platforms, we're curating all kinds of weird science that we're not putting into the episodes. All the stuff that Robert and Joe and I find throughout the day that is just utterly bizarre. And then we've got videos like our Monster Science series and lots of blog posts. Robert in particular is profound and prolific on our blog side. So if you want to hear more from us about, I don't know, music, Monster Science, what'd you cook up this week?
I'm actually working on another Higher Human Forms post, which is a body modification series that I've been doing with a focus more on sort of religious themes and body modification and sort of like religious transhumanism.
I can't remember. Have we talked about American Mary before?
I think it may have come up a few times.
You've seen it?
Yeah. A very interesting horror film.
Yeah, a great horror movie, really interesting take on the body modification community, and directed by twin female sisters that just did an excellent job and co-star in the movie.
Yeah, and they're Canadian to boot.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
They have it all.
Right.
Well, the Saska sisters.
One more way that you can interact with us, especially if you want to talk about horror movies, because that seems like a big thing that goes on there, is on Fridays at noon Eastern Standard Time, we are on Periscope. And basically for, you know, 20 minutes, we will sit there and answer questions that you have. Last week, Joe brought a pretty interesting article about outer space to the table that we discussed with our fans on there. And we'll tell you, you know, some kind of behind the scenes stuff too, like what we're recording that week, what kind of, you know, things are coming up on the show, and vice versa.
But in this episode, we are discussing, an interesting and troubling topic, and that is the idea of psychopathy in children and in adolescents. This is I definitely want to preface here that I in particular am approaching this topic not only as someone who just finds the trope itself kind of fascinating from a cultural standpoint. You know, you can't get away from the killer child, the terrible child, the infant terribles.
It's a trope, I guess, or archetype that I think is like ingrained into human culture, the fear of our own children coming for us. Yeah.
And as a father now, I have to say I feel a lot of that, you know? I mean, when you have this strange creature becoming more and more human in your life, you think about that. You can't help but worry about all the things that could go wrong, or you know, all the problems that could arise. And so I definitely want to drive home that that's in my mind the whole time. So I don't want anyone to come into this thinking that we're going to take a real callous approach to it, that we're all just about, you know, talking about horror movie tie-ins for the topic, because obviously it's a very sensitive issue. And if anyone out there who is planning to have children, already has a child and watching that child develop, this is something that could, a topic that could produce a fair amount of anxiety.
Yeah, but I also think too, like, from reading the literature, that there's a lot to be learned here too, if you're a parent, right? Both about, we're definitely going to be talking about nature, not versus nurture, but and nurture. They're working together here, right? And there's things to look out for, but there's also ways, techniques of parenting that work especially well. Especially if, you know, you think that your child may have the traits of being callous or unemotional in the way that we're going to describe here that subsequently lead to some of these attacks.
Yeah,
I do want to say the original idea for this did come from our October marathon of doing things that were kind of related to Halloween. And it was just one of the things that I couldn't get in under the deadline. I was thinking about the premise of Michael Myers in the Halloween movies, which that he was a kid who killed members of his family, was taken away to a mental asylum for that when he was like 9 years old or something like that.
Yeah.
And then subsequently grew up, escaped, and, you know, was a serial killer.
Yeah, but he's just essentially a black hole of emotion.
Yeah. And so what I wanted to look into there was, is that actually possible? Mm-hmm. Is Michael Myers, the idea there of a child, first of all, and it's hard to find this under a search term, but the term that's used clinically is juvenile homicidal offender. Because when you type in child killer, it usually is associated with people who kill children, not children who kill. And so I was looking to see, you know, what's the likelihood of this actually happening? And then also, you know, in the case of the Michael Myers myth, what's the recidivism look like? So when these children are released as adults, you know, what do their lives look like?
Yeah, and ultimately we're also going to discuss the bright side and some of the treatment options that are becoming available, that are showing promise, because it's easy to get hung up on just the trope, right? On the idea of the, oh, this is a bad seed. This child is just a black hole of emotion and there's no altering that. But
That's the myth, and that's what the media loves to grab onto anytime we have one of these incidents happen, especially in the United States. And it's way more complex than that.
Right.
But the thing that's really interesting is, like you said, like, as we study this further and further and understand the biology behind it, we also find really interesting ways to treat it.
So just to get it out of the way, some of the more common versions of the trope, the bad seed trope that we see, you have Damien from The Omen. That's a big one.
Yeah.
The kids from The Village of the Damned. Mm-hmm. There's The Bad Seed itself, which was a 1956 theatrical film, and a TV movie in 85. You have The Good Son. You have The Ring. You have Peter Wiggin and Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game, who like to torture animals and physically and mentally torment his siblings.
And the animals thing is real, as we'll talk about.
There's a murderous newborn in Ray Bradbury's short story, Small Assassin. There's the young Tom Riddle in Harry Potter, of course. There's Alia in Dune. There's a Mordred Deschain in Stephen King's The Dark Tower series. You could probably count Stewie Griffin. So we have this trope of this child that is just unredeemably bad, that is evil in some inhuman way.
Yeah.
Generally with some sort of magical scenario backing up why they're that way.
I think it's particularly helpful actually here to use Halloween and John Carpenter's vision for Michael Myers as what isn't happening. That's
right.
The fantastic version, right? In that John Carpenter is always referred to that character as the shape, right? He's not human. He's not a product of upbringing or things, you know, mental problems necessarily as much as it's just a body full of evil, right?
Right.
Now, Rob Zombie's version that ultimately changes that in the remake. We don't really need to go down that rabbit hole. But I think that it's important to say that's not what's going on here with children who do kill.
Right. And just to get it out of the way, psychopathy in general, like what is a psychopath? A psychopath demonstrates significantly reduced empathy with the feelings of others. Supporting the theory that this deficit makes it easier for them to inflict pain on victims. Their mirror neurons are too out of whack for them to feel their victim's pain, making the most, you know, cold-blooded of homicides a little easier to commit. So it has to do with a lack of empathy and a callousness in nature, but it's a neurological condition and certainly not some sort of a supernatural occurrence.
So let's get this out of the way to start off with and answer, you know, what my initial question was, which is really how likely are juvenile killers? And in fact, the U.S. Department of Justice has plenty of statistics about this on their website. So you can go there and find this, but I'll share a couple with you here that I think are important. The first is that in 2013, so that's as far back currently as our data shows, the known juvenile offenders that were involved were in 610 murders in the U.S. in 2013. So that sounds like a lot, I know, but that represents 7% of all known murder offenders from that time. So it is relatively small, actually. Also, as of 2013, the number of juvenile homicidal offenders is at its lowest level in 34 years since we started tracking this, which is pretty wild. And in fact, I really recommend going to the Department of Justice's site and looking at the charts that they have built out of this, because apparently the real spike for this was in the 90s. 93 and 94 were particularly bad, and you just see this huge spike. But we are right now, as we're recording this episode, at an all-time low. Or I guess all-time in terms of as long as they've been recording it. Homicide offending also increases with age, so it's less likely that it's going to happen if you are, say, under 15 years old. Only 10% of the offenders were under 15, whereas 76 of them were 16 or 17 years old. And in my mind, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking more along the lines of, like, preteens, juveniles, like, under 13, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And that does happen, but it is, again, significantly small. In 2010, the Justice Department released information saying that 29 children under the age of 14, so this is more along the lines of what I was thinking, had committed homicides that year. And the other interesting thing is that the victims are more likely to be acquaintances. So as of the 2013 data, 37% of them were acquaintances, while 28% of them were total strangers. So the idea of a young child going completely psycho and murdering a total stranger is rare and unlikely.
Now, male juvenile homicide offenders varied substantially, but female juvenile homicide offenders have a steady rate, accounting for a very small share. Less than 100 were implicated in homicides since 2002. And in 2012, of the 8,514 people arrested for murder in the U.S., only one was a girl under 13. In 2013, the number was at its lowest since at least 1980, and there is no evidence that homicide among young girls is increasing.
And this is, I think, important to note, because as some of our listeners will probably have immediately come to mind, I believe it was in, well, it's related to the Creepypasta episode
recorded
recently.
The Slender Man murders, right?
Yeah, and was it 2012, 2013? I can't remember. But, two young girls who were fascinated with the Creepypasta stories about Slender Man tried to murder one of their peers and were unsuccessful. But that story, like, you know, whenever these stories pop up, scared a lot of people and made them think, oh, my God, look at this evidence that young girls are becoming murderers. And in fact, that's not the case if you look at all the data. The other important thing to remember here, too, data-wise, is that a lot of this activity happens in groups. Remember that I mentioned that it was two girls in the Slender Man case. It wasn't just one girl on her own. About half of the number of homicides committed by known juvenile offenders as of 2012 involved multiple offenders. So that's important to realize. You know, children are more likely, we've all been kids And even if you're a child, if you're under 14 listening to this show right now, you know you're more likely to do things that you together than you would alone. I'm sure I know I did things that I regret that I wouldn't have done on my own that I did with a group of friends.
Yeah, so it's easy to imagine any variety of scenarios in which a younger individual is just roped into some sort of horrible situation with older children.
Yeah, and you know the kids can kind of ramp one another up with this
feed off each other's energy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It becomes reality through them talking, and then ultimately peer pressure leads to these risky choices. And many children don't even really understand what dead means. You know, a lot of the kids that are interviewed after they commit these murders, they don't understand that this is a permanent thing. They think of it as sort of being magical. So that's important to remember as well, too, that there's a lack of understanding here of the crime that's being committed. And lastly, before we get into the, you know, the meat behind what's going on inside juvenile homicidal offenders, it's important to note that in June of 2012, the Miller versus Alabama case that was heard by the Supreme Court ultimately decided that juvenile murderers did not have to serve their lives in jail for crimes. This was a tight decision. It was a 5-4 decision in which they chose to ban mandatory life sentences of life imprisonment for juvenile offenders. So now, as of that, decision, those who are convicted of these murders have a possibility of eventual freedom. This is in the U.S., mind you. You know, this stuff happens in other countries, as we'll talk about as well. But, you know, we're here in America. A lot of the research was done in America. So that's, you know, what I'm going to base our information off of. As of right now, the Supreme Court is waiting to hear Montgomery versus Alabama, which is another case that will basically see whether or not they can apply this retroactively, meaning that children who were in prison for life for murders before the 2012 decision will eventually be able to be released.
Yeah, and obviously it's such a tough situation to weigh in on because you're ultimately dealing with adults and trying to figure out how to treat this adult who in their youth, in their childhood even, committed this act before they actually were fully formed as an individual.
Mm-hmm. So there's a few examples here that let's get out of the way of just, you know, known cases where this has happened that have been popularized. One, obviously, Michael Myers being the inspiration for looking into this research is a guy named Edmund Kemper. There's also a person who is known only as Girl A in Japan. She was 14 years old and killed an 11-year-old in Japan in 1997 and mounted his head outside their school. So when this happened, the country's parliament actually lowered the age of criminal responsibility from 16 to 14. So you can see how these singular incidents, which are horrible, by the way.
Yeah, they get a lot of press coverage, and then it becomes an issue for politicians to tackle, and then you get laws on the books.
Exactly. So we've seen just in the last, 5 minutes how both Japan and the United States have changed their laws based on these. There's the Slender Man girls that we were talking about earlier. And one thing I'd like to mention here, just as an anecdote, I don't want to dive into that whole affair, but that when psychiatrists interviewed one of the children who was responsible, she said that she believes in unicorns, that she can communicate with Lord Voldemort and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and she also believes that she has the ability of Vulcan mind control. Huh. So that helps you to kind of put into place here, this is a child who's fantasizing about things. I don't think that she quite understood what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, this seems to illustrate a real inability to distinguish fantasy from reality.
Yeah. And one last example that I want to throw out there, especially because one of our fans mentioned it on Facebook earlier this week, is Mary Flora Bell. In 1968, she strangled two young boys when she was a child. She took a new name and started her life over when she was released from prison in the 1980s. I believe that she's British. So that would explain why, she was released. Mm-hmm. And her daughter, she now has a daughter, were promised a lifetime of anonymity, and this is now referred to over there as a Mary Bell order. So basically, if you commit a crime as a child, and they, deem that you're able to be released, you are, and you can live your life in anonymity if you so choose, so that you don't have to, have that hanging over your head, I guess. I know. So from some of the readings I had about Mary Bell, apparently she was somehow involved in a book about her life and received money for it. And that somehow subsequently let her daughter know about her past actions. Mm-hmm. So there was a little bit of conflict there and a little bit of controversy about the fact that she was being paid to talk about these horrible acts that she'd done.
So obviously, with as with any topic dealing with childhood, this is a big there's a big discussion of nature and nurture here. Like, how much of this is genetics? How much of this is just tendencies that are going to be inherent in you as a person? And then how much of it is the nurturing? How much of it is the level of attention, the level of parental presence and parental guidance that are present there? Where does this behavior emerge from, and how can either side of the scenario curb it?
There's a quote from a book about this that I want to use as sort of a guiding principle for us going forward. It's almost like a thesis statement of what I think that the data and research reveals. And it's by Deborah Nyhoff. She's the author of a book called The Biology of Violence. And her quote is, "Behavior is the result of a dialogue between your brain and your experiences." So it's not just your biology and it's not just your experiences. It's those two interacting together. And we, you know, I remember, especially in school, often being told about the nature v. nurture argument, you know, almost like a Supreme Court case. Which one is it? And it's both, and especially in this situation.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left, look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
So think about it this way. Childhood development essentially works like this. In our preteen and teenage years, both girls and boys develop intense social relationships. Especially when we're adolescents, we like to, you know, become independent and we feel everything really intensely, right? Well, what's going on there is that our prefrontal cortex, this is the part of our brain that's in charge of critical thinking, judgment, and deliberation, hasn't fully developed. In fact, like even when we're adolescents, you know, some of us like to think of, well, when I was 15, I was basically an adult or whatever. I don't know. I don't when I look back on that. I was an idiot. But that's essentially what's going on. Our brains are still developing. So there's lots of room for how they develop, right? And one of the quotes about this from a researcher looking into it said, it's like they are in a muscle car without brakes. I like that analogy. That's what high school felt like for me.
That sounds about right. I mean, it's easy to forget just how much is going on in the high school mind. It seems like so high schoolers can seem so alien. Teenagers can seem so alien. And in a sense, they are. Like they're thinking and changing in some very dramatic ways. A 1990s National Institute of Health project scanned over 100 teen brains, as well as some younger individuals and some older ones. And they found that as we grow, our brains undergo just massive reorganization between our 12th and 25th year.
That's crazy to think that, yeah, like even up until 25, we are still maturing and developing.
Yeah. I mean, I look back and I'm like, yeah, that totally makes
totally
sense.
Makes
at least
sense.
25, maybe,
yeah,
more.
Being older than 25 now. Yeah. I can definitely look back. I remember being 25 though and thinking like, I got this under control. I totally didn't.
Yeah, I've seen it described as a slow wave, and subsequent imaging work has shown that the physical changes, they all start in the brain's rear and they move toward the front, from areas close to the brain stem that look after older, you know, more basic primal functions, and then move forward through our ability to process all of that stimuli. And during this period too, you see this idea that a teenage brain also is going to be super obsessed with making social connections with other individuals. And I've seen this argued as kind of an evolutionary advantage to where the teen has evolved to leave its family and find a home with, yeah, new people, and therefore the brain is looking for that example and it's willing to take more risks in order to carry it out.
This brain development is definitely something that I have to wonder if it's more recent for humanity, in that like that we're developing up until the age of 25. I mean, that somewhat makes sense for us now, in that like we don't, in our current culture in America, we don't consider ourselves, quote, adult until we're 18, right? But like the responsibilities of children in much earlier ages, even just going back to the medieval age, were so much earlier. You know, I wonder if over time that there was a gradual progression of getting to this point where the brain was allowed to develop more and more and more as we got older.
Or, you know, you can think of it in terms of something like a butterfly, where it's all the stages that take place in, yeah, order to reach that point where the butterfly is just around to breed and do its thing and die.
That's
so
true, yeah.
You could say that really past 25, or not too much past 25, is just kind of extra time Just the, you know, the landing strip.
Everything we got after 25. That's why after 25, you're like a village elder.
Yeah. Yes.
That's scary, isn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, the bottom line is that, yeah, a ton of mental development takes place during this time span. And the brain of the child, the brain of the teen, even, you know, on up in 25 year olds is a different beast than the adult brain.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get into psychopathy then, specifically in kids, right? So right up front, I want to distinguish like psychopathy and being psychotic are two totally different things.
Right.
So we are talking about psychopathy and psychopaths today. Mm-hmm. And there's also, those are basically the same thing as sociopathy, right? So when these terms are thrown around, it's important to remember that, that there's a difference here. But so it gets back to what we were talking about earlier. They're referred to in some corners as CU kids, right? Because they're callous and unemotional. They show little empathy for others or remorse for their own actions. And like you said earlier, they're prone to violence.
Yeah. And the CU thing, I think, is important, too, when it comes to labeling, so that in the treatment of these children, you have something other than psychopath to throw around, which is such a loaded term.
It's super loaded. Yeah. And it's especially, you know, just, oh, to be a parent and to have that term applied to your kid is terrifying, not only because of, you know, the implications, but also because that is a label that is going to determine the outcome of their life.
And I think the research is showing more and more that psychopathy is, it's not that situation where, oh, this child has the mark and this one doesn't, but rather there are varying levels. There's a spectrum upon which a vast majority of people are going to pop up.
In a lot of ways, I saw it compared in the literature to both autism and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Yes.
And not that there are similar things going on in the brain. In fact, they're not. But that, like you said, there's gradations, and there's different ways in which that affects the person's ability to interact with their community, right?
Right.
But at the same time, there are also different and growing ways to treat and, not cure necessarily. I don't think that's the right word, but to help these children, grow out of it.
Right.
So, how do they figure that out? They've got a couple different tools that are essentially tests that they give them. One is the inventory of callous, unemotional traits. I really wish we had access to one of these that we could have taken before the podcast, because I have to wonder where I would score on these. The other is the child psychopathy scale, and then they use a modified version of a test for adults that's called the antisocial process screening device. So all these are various, I think, written and oral tests that essentially tell psychologists, you know, kind of where on the spectrum these children fall. Now, this is a crazy statistic right here. A recent estimate by the neuroscientist Kent Keel placed the national cost of psychopathy, this is in the U.S., at $460 billion a year. That's 10 times the cost of depression. And the reason why is because, in part, psychopaths tend to be arrested repeatedly. So that leads us to, you know, we're jumping ahead a little bit, but that insinuates that there's a bit of recidivism that goes on here.
So setting aside the examples you've seen in movies and whatnot, here are some actual examples of the kind of behavior one might encounter with CU kids. Mm-hmm. So callous and emotional children tend to be highly manipulative. And again, this is one of those situations where you can look at any child and you can see levels of manipulation. So it's easy to get carried away in diagnosing the children in your life.
Yeah.
Trying to get that cookie, right? Trying to manipulate a parent into letting them do this or that.
Yeah. And I would imagine too that there are times, not being a parent myself, but I would imagine there are times when you are a parent that your patience is running thin and you might be more prone to say, wait a minute.
Yeah. I got to get this little psychopath.
Is Jimmy a psychopath?
Yeah. So you kids also may lie frequently, not just to avoid punishment, as all children will.
Yeah, that's important to distinguish.
Yeah. Or to just get out of brushing their teeth or
all
something, you know.
All kids lie.
Yeah.
It's like something out of The Wire. Like, all children lie.
Well, yeah. I mean, the power of discovering the lie, you know, the almost magical nature of it, that you can say a thing and in doing so kind of make it true.
Yeah.
Like, that's big magic, even as an adult and as a kid, all the more. But with CU children, there's going to be a more likelihood that they're just going to lie for the sake of lying for no reason. You're going to see poor impulse control. And I should probably just go ahead and drive home that impulse control is something that, that you see, sort of gradually come online as well.
Yeah.
It's going to vary from child to child, but generally speaking, the younger the child, the less impulse control. And then as they develop, it's going to improve.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. By, generally by age 15, an individual taking an impulse control test are going to be able to do as well, as an adult about 70 to 80% of the time, if they're applying themselves and, you know, and thinking about it. But with CU kids in particularly poor impulse control. You're going to see that they're unrepentant in their behavior. They're not going to, you know, cave and say they're sorry about something.
Mm-hmm.
And like adult psychopaths, they can seem to lack humanity, to an outside observer. They might seem like that Michael Myers kid. But of course there's a lot more going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd like to add here before we go on that a really great piece that we found, for the literature for this episode was in the New York Times Magazine, actually, and it was published in 2012. The article is called Can You Call a 9-Year-Old a Psychopath? And I posted it to our Facebook page this week, but, you can easily Google that if you want. A really fascinating long form read that, this journalist embedded herself in a family with a child. I can't remember how old he was, but, who was diagnosed as being CU, potentially a psychopath, and was actually attending school isn't the right word. It was like a center.
It was
right?
More of a summer camp program, a summer program that was kind of, it was an offshoot of a program aimed at children with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And this was this branch of the camp was aimed at children, CU kids. The piece that we're discussing here is excellent. And it really puts a human face on.
Absolutely.
Scenario.
It goes very in depth into the experiences of this child's mother and father. And also his siblings as well as getting into the data and talking to psychologists. I was very impressed with the work in there.
Yeah. Incidentally, the camp that we're talking about was held by a Florida International University.
Okay.
Yeah. And speaking of the heredity of the kid, we kind of come back to the nature side of it here and heritability of callous and emotional traits might be as high as 80%.
Wow.
Yeah.
And from that piece, what I remember is, they spoke to his father and the father said, yeah, when I was a kid, I also had social issues. I also was unemotional and unresponsive, but I grew out of it.
Yeah. And, in the piece, they also quote, Purdue psychologist Donald Lynam. And, he points out that it's no higher than the heritability for anxiety and depression. Both of those conditions have large genetic risk factors, but of course we can treat them.
Mm.
And so the idea here is that there's a lot of hope and a lot of data that supports the notion that this is treatable as well. This is not some, cosmic black mark on an individual that can't be addressed.
Right. Absolutely. Even though it sounds like it. Again, I think there's a stigma attached to the word psychopath.
Yeah.
Right. In fact, I almost think that it would benefit psychology to come up with a different term. And maybe that's why they use CU kids, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Because it does cling to this kind of outdated notion that that it can't be treated, that it can't be cured. And we're seeing more and more research that shows that yes, there are ways, there are treatments that can work with adults even to bring some level of compassion online.
Whereas the term psychopath implies culturally this child is evil.
Yeah.
Nothing will do anything about it. Well, and so we talked about how it's assessed, but, you know, I threw out those tests earlier, but in fact, there's no standard way to just figure this out. In fact, some psychologists believe that it's a distinct neurological condition, and that, you know, maybe we'd be able to identify it in children as young as 5 years old, but it's difficult, right? Especially because their brains are still developing and because normal behavior at these ages can sometimes be misinterpreted as psychopathic. I could totally see that. My interactions with under 5 year olds is limited, but you have quite a few.
Yeah. It's like I say, there are days when you think, oh, they're all complete psychopaths, but really, yeah, they're kids.
So, all right, while you may have a genetic disposition for these behaviors, childhood trauma and a lack of connection with other people helps bring them out, okay? So this is the nurture side of the angle. This is the experiences side of it. So psychologists try to work on intervention with kids who have early signs of psychopathy so that they can prevent those experiences from exacerbating it. So, yeah, we think that there's a genetic component that's involved here in antisocial personality disorders. But depending on how we grow up, that can either exaggerate those problems or help us straighten them out. You know, that's the terminology that some people use, straighten it out. I think the idea was that it's sort of like a rubber band, right? In adults, real-life psychopathy doesn't always lead to violence either, too. So that's important to distinguish. Some successful members of society would be deemed psychopaths if they were assessed by a clinician. In fact, this reminds me, our colleagues at Stuff They Don't Want You to Know did a video one time on, I believe it was on corporate CEOs and the psychopathy scale, uh-huh, and where they would fall on it. And in a lot of times, I believe the thesis of their video is that, yes, those who tend to be successful also tend to be to rate as psychopaths. It reminds me of the study that we were talking about in our episode on the Ig Nobel Prizes about CEOs who had experienced disastrous natural disasters where there were fatal incidents, and those who hadn't seen those repercussions were more likely to take risk.
Yeah, so you have the idea that the CEO themselves is a psychopath. I've seen, of course, studies say that a company as a whole is essentially a psychopath in the way its policies and
if it's treated as a person,
as it's treated as a person. Mm-hmm. And and on top of that, I feel like the more you read about actual psychopathic traits and how actual sociopaths function, you begin to just see more and more of them around you in your daily life.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. And here's the thing too, especially if you're a parent. So some parenting can actually make child psychopathy worse, and it depends on how you're parenting, right? So, some psychologists say that by punishing your child for behaving violently or callously, that actually leads the child to acting out in even more extreme ways. And in that New York Times article, mm-hmm, we certainly saw that with the child that was the case study there. But there's therapies for intervention and therapies that can kind of help parents out too. Sometimes starting as young as when the child is 2 years old, which kind of blows my mind because I can't imagine being able to diagnose a 2 year old with this. But it is very difficult to identify, not just in at risk children, but especially because they haven't started socializing yet, right? So, it's only up until they start socializing that you're going to start seeing the callousness and the unresponsiveness. And also, like, as we talked about earlier, kids with autism or ADHD may be similarly antisocial, but that's a whole totally different kind of brain structure. So there's screening tests, there's the oral and written tests that we talked about, and they'll help a clinician identify psychopathy, but there's still a lot of complications involved. And lastly, I'd just say that parents who are withdrawn or remote are also risking shaping a child who shuts down emotionally. And this is difficult when you think about the hereditary aspect, right? Because if a parent had some unemotional, potentially callous behaviors in their nature, then it's going to be even more difficult for them to be interactive and not shut down emotionally with their children, right? So it's sort of this is a silly term, but it's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, I mean, because if the nature is already skewing psychopathic, then the nurture is likely going to as well from the parent contributing those genes.
Yeah, so in the same way that punishment can contribute to it, neglect can also contribute to it. Mm-hmm. That it can actually impair cortex development, and this is the stuff that controls the feelings or belonging an attachment in our brains. And that is a perfect segue into talking about brain anatomy.
But first, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
All right, we're back. So according to MRI scans, psychopaths tend to have smaller subgenial cortex, 5 to 10% reduction in brain density in parts of the paralimbic system. That's where empathy and social values and moral decision making takes place. And this includes the orbitofrontal cortex and the caudate. And these are all critical for reinforcing positive outcomes and discouraging negative outcomes. So this gets down to just the basic principles of why do I behave the way that I behave? What's encouraging me to do the right thing and feel responsible for my actions?
Yeah, it really made me consider, I wonder what the shape of my brain is and how it's contributing to my behaviors and characteristics and things like that. It's not something that we usually as human beings kind of back up and think about, you know?
Well, it's difficult to do, right? Because you get into that whole blind brain idea that the brain can't really perceive itself, and we're trying to, we can't stand on the outside of self and look in. So we have this kind of,
backdoor mirror way of trying to,
the looking glass self. Yeah. Yeah. Which is often distorted.
Yeah.
So there's one really great study that I think contributes to the dialogue about children with psychopathy, specifically juvenile homicidal offenders, and how the biology is working here. And this came out in 2014. It was published in NeuroImage, Clinical Volume 4. And the article has a ton of authors, so I'm not going to list them all. But it was called Abnormal Brain Structure in Youth Who Commit Homicide. So essentially, this group of researchers looked at young incarcerated homicidal offenders, and they found that they have reduced gray matter volumes in their medial and lateral temporal lobes, including the hippocampus and the posterior insula. And this is relative to compared youth who are not homicidal offenders. So from this, we know that their brains are shaped differently and they have less gray matter. That's the essential discovery here. The growing research indicates that the temporal poles are responsible, these are the areas where there's less gray matter, for social and emotional processing. And this included detecting deception and moral decision-making, as well as inferring the emotional states of others. So that makes sense in terms of thinking about the traits of psychopathy that we talked about earlier. So these are the regions of your brain that govern critical cognitive control and emotion. And they cited some other studies here too. One was that male youth with conduct disorder had reduced gray matter in their left amygdala and anterior insula compared to the healthy control subset. And these reductions were related to aggressive behaviors. In yet another study, adolescent males with conduct disorder had reduced gray matter in the left orbital frontal cortex and bilateral temporal lobes, as well as the left amygdala and the hippocampus. So all of this together is kind of saying, all right, they had previously looked at boys with conduct disorder. They had looked at, what kind of gray matter they were missing. And they said, well, wait a minute. Conduct disorder seems to be connected to homicidal incidents with juveniles. Is the same thing going on there? And yes, it is. It's less gray matter. It's just in different parts of the brain, essentially. So in this specific study, the way that they analyzed the brain structure was they took youth who committed homicides and they did MRI scans on them. And they introduced the following variables into their data set. They added their IQ, their age at the time of scan, the number of traumatic brain injuries they'd received with a loss of consciousness. They used a test for psychopathy called the Hare Psychopathy Test List, and they used the, quote, youth version. I guess there's separate versions depending on how old you are. Whether or not these kids had substance dependencies, the years of regular substance abuse that they had, and what their psychiatric diagnoses and violent, nonviolent, drug, and total other convictions were. So all of these things combined, right? Now, like I said, prior work showed that there was reduced temporal pole gray matter that was related to psychopathic traits. But the interesting thing in this particular study is that the homicide group and the non-homicide subsample did not differ in psychopathic traits per the scores that they took on that test there that I mentioned earlier, the psychopathy, the Hare psychopathy youth version. Mm-hmm. So they, the authors of this study say there is no observation that can be made that psychopathy is involved here, right? We can't say that. What we can say is that juveniles who commit murder have less of this gray matter.
Okay. So it becomes increasingly more difficult to try and say this is the brain of a homicidal young offender. It's far more complicated than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. But here's the good news. Other research has shown that our gray matter is malleable, right? So one study shows that 15 minutes of daily mirror reading for 2 weeks can increase the dorsolateral occipital gray matter. That's fascinating to me that just by doing that, you can change the shape of your brain or the volume of your brain. So it's possible that through cognitive training like this, or possibly, pharmaceutical interventions or therapy or other types of behavior modification, that you can help these kids to develop out of these behaviors that could potentially lead to them killing someone.
Now, there does seem to be a link between low levels of cortisol and below normal function of the amygdala. That's the part of our brains that processes fear and shame. So usually we want to avoid these sensations, and that plays a big role in our behavioral motivation. So it gets down at root to just how our brains function in the face of fear and shame, and how much of our behavior is aimed at avoiding those sensations.
So when researchers have looked specifically at areas of the brain that are associated with fear and empathy, they found a couple of things. Sheila Hodgins, she's a professor of psychology at the University of Montreal. She conducted experiments. You know, a lot of this comes down to basically MRI scans. And in this case, she did MRI scans on adult psychopaths. I don't believe that they are homicidal offenders. And she found that even if they're non-violent, their brains are different. They have abnormal connections between their posterior cingulate and the insular cortex. Similar structures were found in preteen boys with callous, unemotional states. So I believe that that's referring to those other studies before the one looking specifically at juvenile homicidal offenders. But these brains are, like we said, they're malleable, they're highly plastic. Kids can grow out of these. Remember what we were talking about earlier? I mean, our brains are developing until we're 25 years old.
Yeah.
Like, this is something we can take action.
Yeah, it's worth remembering that in A Clockwork Orange, Alex essentially grows out of his behavior.
That's
in the book, anyway.
Yeah.
I think they left that last chapter out of the movie.
But we're talking a lot about the brain part here, right? But let's remember that there's the nurture part as well. So, young brains, especially those from 0 to 3 years old, are especially vulnerable to hurt, right? And that's, you know, probably part of why culturally we're so averse to the idea of anybody hurting an infant or a toddler, right?
Right.
So children who suffer physical abuse, stress, neglect, or terror can absolutely have changes in their brains from this. The flood of stress chemicals resets how the brain is triggered during fight or flight situations, right? So in some cases, they'll be triggered too much. In some cases, they won't be triggered at all. It can lead to impulsive aggression. So, yeah, no duh. Abusive parents can lead to youth violence. That makes sense, right? Especially given, like, I guess our world experience. But also, remember, it's not just abusive parents doing this. It's also that there's something going on with the brain ahead of time that contributes.
And it's also worth noting that the conditions that we mentioned there can often line up, unfortunately, with institutionalized care in the form of orphanages. So that's also a factor to take into account here.
And so, you know, on the other end of that, it could lead to antisocial personalities when the brain system of stress has just become totally unresponsive. So typically these kind of kids, and I think this is the CU type kids, they have low heart rates, they have impaired emotional sensitivity, right? In fact, Paul Frick, a psychologist at the University of New Orleans, has studied the risk factors for psychopathy in children for 20 years, and he described one boy who used a knife to cut off the tail of their family cat bit by bit over a period of weeks. This is from that New York Times article. In fact, the parents didn't even notice. It took them quite a long time because it was so small. I don't think the cat was like in pain and letting them know or bleeding or something like that. But this gets back to kind of what we insinuated earlier, is that a common symptom in these traits of CU kids is that they will abuse animals.
Yeah, and of course it's important to note too that some level of, like, if your child hits the cat or steps on a bug,
right,
a certain level of this is just a natural way in which a child figures out how pain works, how the limits of its body and its powers to impact its environmental surroundings, how all of that functions. So,
yeah.
So don't freak out if you listen to this and then you catch a child slapping at the cat.
You know, out there you can make judgments about a childhood me, but I believe I was like maybe 3 or 4 years old and I took the family cat and put him inside my toy chest and just closed him in there. I mean, it was a big chest. It wasn't like a tiny thing, but I didn't understand. I was just like, oh, he goes in here now with the toys.
Yeah.
And my parents were like, where's the cat? And they finally found the cat in there, you know. And I just didn't get it. You know, I I would hesitate to say that at any point I've been callous or unemotional in my life. That's probably the opposite.
Well, see, we've curbed a lot of that by just having a largely callous and unemotional cat. So,
Oh yeah. That's perfect.
Yeah. So she lashes out against our son and then
just bats him occasionally. Yeah. Yeah. That's how my cat treats my dog. But so, okay. To be serious about this, without unconditional love, children can fail to develop the right neural circuits that control their capability to feel or form healthy relationships. And in particular, this makes them especially hypersensitive to perceived injustice, and also often accompanied by when they're feeling powerless as well. So we saw that in the New York Times article, there was a lot of examples of this with the child Michael that was the case study, in which he perceived an injustice against himself and he perceived powerlessness. And so he would lash out against his siblings, or he'd lash out against his parents or other kids in the program that he was in.
Now, there's some other brain pathologies that can lead to violence as well. Lesions of the frontal lobe can induce apathy and distort judgment and emotion. The cingulate gyrus that curves through the center of the brain is hyperactive in murderers, and it just shifts from one thought to another. When it becomes impaired, people get stuck on one thought. It becomes an obsession.
Yeah.
The prefrontal cortex is sluggish in murderers as well. And these damages to the brain can result from head trauma as well as exposure to toxic substances like alcohol even during gestation.
Okay, so I think that what we've established up to this point is that there's a lot of evidence that damage to the brain, however it occurs, can contribute to this, but that also experiences in childhood can also contribute not only to your behaviors, but how your brain is formed.
Yeah, the human mind is a nature-nurture cocktail and a rather complicated recipe at that. There are a number of things that can throw it off whack, and even if it's off whack, even if the drink recipe is a little different, it doesn't mean it's not drinkable. That doesn't mean it can't fully function within society.
So now let's get to the third part of the question that I wanted to answer when we started out on this, which is, how likely is juvenile homicide recidivism, right? You remember we were talking at the beginning about that girl in Britain who had committed murder as a young child in the 60s and then was released and was anonymous, Mary Bell, and had a child. In fact, I think she's a grandmother now. How likely is it, you know, in her case, she didn't recede, but what about other children? Well, unfortunately, this is really hard to predict. In fact, the 2014 national report from the National Center for Juvenile Justice and the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention says that there is no national recidivism rate for juveniles. The reason why is that each state has a very different juvenile justice system that differs in organization, administration, and data capacity. So we can't pull all this data together and make national judgments on it, is essentially what they're saying. And in fact, 11 states in the United States don't even report data on juvenile offenders. So it's really difficult to make any kind of, you know, judgment call in the United States. But what about other countries? Well, there was a study out of the Netherlands that indicated that male juvenile homicidal offenders, and those in particular that maintain relationships with delinquents, are at a greater risk for reoffending. So it is possible. That is a very different subsample. That's just in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. But in that particular study, they did find that they're at a high rate for recidivism. So, and another thing that came out of this New York Times study was a really interesting look into a researcher named Lee Robbins. He was a psychiatry researcher. And he conducted a series of studies on children who had behavioral problems and followed them into adulthood. And his studies revealed two things. The first was that nearly every psychopathic adult was deeply antisocial as a child. The second was that almost 50% of the children who scored high on measures of antisocial qualities did not go on to become psychopathic adults. So, in other words, they were necessary but not sufficient in predicting who ultimately would become a violent criminal. So that's good to know. So these tests don't necessarily indicate if you're a child and you score high on them that you're going to grow up and become a violent criminal, right?
Yeah, because growing up is key. There's still so much growing up, so much development to come. Mm-hmm. This is not the finished product.
All the experiences, yeah. And yeah. It even, again, like I keep coming back to that. We're maturing. Our brain is maturing until we're 25 years old. That, you know, in my experience, that's you get 7 years out of high school where your brain is still maturing based on whatever experiences you have there.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it forces you certainly to reevaluate your own life up till 25 and maybe make you a little more compassionate towards the teenagers in your midst.
Now I think I understand why in America, you have to be 25 before you can rent a car.
Oh yeah, that would make sense. Give me only full form organisms are allowed to pilot these. So, one of the big questions, of course, here is, to what extent is it treatable? So the big hope here, and there's some good, evidence to back this up, is that there's still a capacity for empathy, and it controlled by specific parts of the brain that still exist in a weakened state, and then they can be strengthened, especially if we act early enough to rewire the developing brain. And this brings to mind a couple of studies that I've looked at in the past. There's a 2013, both were 2013 studies, actually. One was published in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience, and the other is a study from the Social Brain Lab in of the University Medical Center in Groningen. And these looked at psychopathic inmates, adults, and looked at a treatment opportunity. So the one in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience that I mentioned, they used fMRI scans of the brains of 121 medium security prison inmates during the viewing of painful visual stimuli, stubbed toes, smashed fingers, that sort of thing, stuff that makes you go ouch. The researchers then asked the subjects to imagine the pain happening to themselves as well as to others. The results, well, when highly psychopathic subjects imagined the pain happening to themselves, brain regions involved in empathy for pain lit up like normal in their minds.
Huh.
When they imagined the pain inflicted on others, the same regions failed to activate. And this lines up with that 2013 study from the Social Brain Lab. Their findings suggested that the psychopath's empathic abilities didn't kick in automatically, but could be turned on by conscious will, by exercise, by repetition. So both of these studies,
again, it's a muscle, essentially.
Yeah, it's like a muscle. Think of it as a muscle that needs to be strengthened.
Yeah.
As a default setting that is off rather than on, and there has to be a little more conscious will and routine.
Just requires a little training and maintenance. Yeah.
Yeah, they seem to suggest that these sort of treatments, these mirror treatments, these empathy treatments, are going to show a lot of promise with individuals of varying ages. The equipment's there. It's just a matter of making sure that it's turning on.
Okay. So, all right. Let's go back to where we started here. We had three questions. The first was, how likely are juvenile homicidal offenders? How likely is it that children will kill people? And the answer is not very.
Yeah, it's pretty slim. No, they're blown out in the media and in our sort of cultural mythology, but realistically speaking, slim chances.
Yeah. And then the second question would be, well, why is this happening? Why do they do this? And the answer is that it's a very complicated mixture of nature and nurture, right? Mm-hmm. Brain activity as well as their experiences and their interaction with their families and peers.
Right.
And then the third question was, well, how likely is it that the very small amount of them that do commit these crimes will recede if they're released from jail? And the answer is that we don't know. Like, maybe the Netherlands, it seems to be the case that they might, but U.S. data is all over the place. So as of right now, it's really hard to pinpoint an answer on that one.
There are just so many factors involved with each individual. It's not like the psychopath is like one clone of another.
Yeah.
And they're just, those are psychopathic organisms there. No, it's a far more complex neurological condition.
But so the good news, though, is that, like what we were talking about just now and earlier, that the brain is malleable, that our behaviors can be formed and we can learn to better interact with other human beings.
Yeah.
You know, it's a taught thing. And the actual activity of doing that sort of rewires and reshapes things so that it's easier to do.
All right. So there you have it. The psychopathic child,
the homicidal child, the callous and emotional child, a reasonably deep dive into what's going on inside their minds, as far as we can tell, and what can be done to cope with it.
So I guess the answer to my initial question is Michael Myers possible? Is yes, but not likely.
Yeah.
Sure, it could happen, but it's very unlikely.
Now, I know we have a lot of listeners out there with something to share about this. We've all had childhoods. A number of people out there have children as well in their life. So we may even have some listeners who themselves have callous and emotional traits or have children with callous and emotional traits. And yeah. We would love to hear from you. And certainly, if you want your name to remain anonymous, just make a note of that. And
we'll always respect that.
How to get in touch with us? Well, you can always go to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all of the podcast episodes. That's where you'll find blog posts, videos, most importantly, like links out to our social media accounts, such as Facebook, where we're Blow the Mind, Twitter, we're Blow the Mind there as well, Tumblr, we're Stuff to Blow Your Mind. All of those pages have some way to interact with us and send us questions and feedback.
Yeah, and if you want to just write us directly and have us read your mail, potentially in a listener mail episode, or just respond to you privately, we'd love to do that too, and you can always reach us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.